very special guest is Randall Carlson from sacredgeometryinternational.info. And where we left off, you were talking about the alleged fraud of the sixth great mass extinction, were you?
Well, I didn't use the word fraud, but, you know,
I think... That's why I used the word alleged.
Oh, okay. Well, I think what's important is that we place it into context. And when we talk about mass extinctions, they say the sixth great mass extinction is referring to there are previously five great mass extinctions. And, of course, the worst was the Permian-Triassic extinction of 245 million years ago, followed by an extinction in the Ordovician period, another one in at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, which is probably the most famous, which is the 65 million year ago event where the actually closer to 66 million were the dinosaurs and the great ammonites and things. It was a global extinction episode in which roughly 75% of all species disappeared in a very short period of time in terms of geological time. And when we talk about now we're in the middle of the sixth great mass extinction, the assumption is that what's going on now is comparable in severity and magnitude to the previous five. Now, I should say that the most famous one, the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction, is generally considered the third within the lineup of severity. So right in the middle, right? Now, as it stands now, you know, there are a lot of assumptions about how many species are going extinct, but it's not really based on actual species counts. It's based upon assumptions of how many unknown species there are living in, how many hectares of habitat that are potentially or theoretically destroyed each year. And so it's a completely hypothetical number based upon computer models. It's not actually based upon any counting of actual species mortality. If you don't count island extinctions, and certainly, you know, New Zealand is generally included in the anthropogenic extinction models because, you know, you had the giant flightless moa birds there, and the blame for their extinction is usually placed upon the arrival of the Maori people some 800 years ago. Because there's associated with the geological horizon at which the moas disappeared, there's also abundant charcoal. Now, charcoal is usually attributed to fires, human-induced fires. Well, though if you actually talk to the Maori people themselves, they're not going to accept blame for the extinction of the moa birds. They basically have legends about fire coming from the sky. And I actually am more inclined personally to believe the traditions of the Maori rather than the archaeologists or the paleontologists or the zoologists, that because they see this layer of charcoal, they assume that essentially the Maoris arrived, hunted all the moa birds to extinction in overnight and set fire to all the vegetation of the island for whatever reason. Just doesn't make sense. Just doesn't make sense.
And if anybody's ever been out in the New Zealand bush lighting a single fire in any way, shape, or form, trying to find enough dry stuff to get that is freaking impossible.
I'm glad to hear that straight from your... From the mouth of an indigenous person there, right? Because that's what I had sort of guessed, actually, to be the case.
Let's burn down the rainforest. Brilliant idea. Brilliant.
Yeah. Let's completely, you know, sabotage our own possibility of any kind of economic future at all here. We'll just destroy the whole infrastructure of our society just for the...
When the settlers came in, they did do a heck of a lot of burning to clear farmland.
Yes. I'm apparently aware of. And the question is, can we then now extrapolate backwards and assume that the arrival of the Maori people 800 years ago did the same thing? I think they were primarily hunters rather than farmers. So I don't know if they had any incentive to clear lots and lots of farmland. But in any case, going from, you know, New Zealand to, you know, other island extinctions like Madagascar, for example, it's generally assumed without any real hard empirical evidence that it was the arrival of humans. We see that the last mass extinction in Earth history, which was at the end of the Pleistocene 13,000 years ago, when all of the megafauna disappeared. Now, of course, you had a tremendous bestiary of megafauna in Australia that went extinct about 20,000 years earlier than the megafauna in the rest of the world that went extinct. And this is, it sometimes has been blamed on the arrival of the Aboriginal peoples, which, again, I don't believe, because Aboriginal peoples have their own traditions about what caused the extinction of the Australian megafauna. And, again, I, without going into the details on it, I strongly suspect and believe that it was a natural catastrophic episode rather than anything that the humans did. Humans had a role in it. It may have been only finishing off surviving species in the aftermath of a catastrophe. Likewise, you know, in the northern hemisphere, there was about 120 species of mega mammals that went extinct at the end of the last ice age. You know, you probably, you know, or know that there were woolly mammoths. You know, North America here, we had more elephants in North America than Africa does now. And that's kind of bizarre when you think about it. There were mastodons and four different species of woolly mammoths. So there's actually five species of proboscideans in North America prior to the end of the last ice age. There were giant ground sloths. There were giant cave bears. There were saber-toothed cats. There were beavers that weighed 500-600 pounds. This went on and on and on and on, about 120, 125 species. Well, come between 11 and 13,000 years ago, all of those species went extinct. Woolly mammoths went extinct over the entire globe. Mastodons did as well. Mastodons ranged all the way into South America. They went extinct. The tendency has
I have
been,
a different theory.
What is I your believe, theory,
Danny? I believe that the woolly mammoths and the incredibly slow sloths bred together and evolved into the modern obese American culture?
Well, you know, there, you may have something there. You know, I basically look at the present incarnation of our government, and the nearest creature that I can liken to describe by analogy what our present government has evolved into is Jabba the Hutt from the old Star Wars. And you know, perhaps when a creature like that becomes so slothful it can no longer move, you know, things change, it can't adapt. I definitely think there's analogies here between what goes on in nature and what goes on in society.
People think that society is detached from nature because we're not living in the bush or something, you know, we're not natural creatures or something like that. But the same thing that affects the world and all the creatures in it affects us too. And why wouldn't we follow the same patterns?
Of course it does. And, of course, we have built our advanced industrial society when in an interval of relatively calm climate and environmental change. And, see, there's my point here that I'm trying to make is there's we can't take anything for granted. And I was trying, I guess, getting back to this, the question here, which we're kind of digressing from somewhat, but still it pertains to the question of this sixth grade mass extinction. So my point is that if we actually count the number of species, not counting the species that have disappeared on islands, because I think that's questionable. I don't think we can just, without any further critical thought, blame all that on humans, the arrival of humans, every time we see an island extinction. But if we actually count the number of species that we know of that have gone extinct as a result of our activities, it's probably only about a dozen species. You know, a lot of the species...
Can I ask, is this part of the environmental movement as well to demonize man as a cancer on the planet by blaming us for everything that happens?
By blaming us for everything, absolutely, absolutely. And like I said before, it has its roots within, you know, the prevailing paradigm at the time that the environmental movement began in the late 60s and early 70s was strictly gradualistic. See, nobody back then was thinking about the fact that, you know, maybe every few thousand years the planet might get struck by an asteroid or, you know, a gigantic volcanic eruption that spews, you know, 500 cubic kilometers of ash into the atmosphere. People just weren't thinking along those lines. They were basically thinking that the history of the Earth had been generally pretty quiet, calm, peaceful, gradual, uniform, until humans came along to upset the balance of nature, see? And that paradigm still dominates environmentalist thinking. And I have conversations all the time with them. I read a lot of them. I still, in my own way, think of myself as an environmentalist. But I'm now realizing and have realized for 20-some years now that there are factors, much bigger players in the environmental stability of this planet than what anything we humans have yet contributed to it. And let me put this into perspective. We talk about the sixth great mass extinction. We'll take the middle one, the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary extinction of 65 million years ago. We know that the Earth got struck by at least one asteroid. I mean, that's unequivocally demonstrated. The asteroid has struck the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. It left a crater 150 to 180 miles in diameter. The object was about 6 miles in diameter. It was probably moving 25 to 30,000 miles per hour when it hit. When an object like that strikes the Earth, that in that particular case, it released explosive energy equivalent to a couple of 100 million megatons. Now, to put that in perspective, think about it. At the height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, late 60s, early 70s, the total nuclear arsenals of both sides was between 10 and 12,000 megatons. I'll say that again. Between 10 and 12,000 megatons, right? Now, imagine what kind of environmental havoc and social havoc would have been wrought had we engaged in an all-out thermonuclear war back then. Imagine that we unleashed all of the thousands of nuclear warheads on both sides, raining down on the cities, creating, thousands of nuclear explosions. The total amount of energy released into the global environment would have been, in round numbers, about 10,000 megatons. The asteroid that struck the Yucatan Peninsula released energy on the order of 200 million megatons. Think about that. Okay, now, when that happened, you had most of the vegetation on planet Earth burned up. You had seismic events all over the planet that were perhaps measured in 10 to 11 on the Richter scale. You had outpouring of tremendous amounts, tens of thousands of cubic miles of basaltic lava in India, the Deccan Traps, which released huge, huge amounts of sulfur into the atmosphere, poisoning the atmosphere. It's likely, according to some studies, that for a while the rainfall that was happening globally may have had the pH of acid, a battery acid. You would have had the skies darkened for years. Now, you think about that, and there's now evidence that possibly there was a second great impact into the Indian Ocean. Indian geologists have discovered a huge crater, even bigger than the one that's in the Yucatan, that appears to be on the bottom of the Indian Ocean, that also looks like it's dating to the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary of 66 million years ago. Plus, there were at least half a dozen smaller impacts around the globe that are also dating to that same period. Now, you think about that. Think about, a couple of 100 million megatons of energy. You're talking about on the order of 10 billion Hiroshima bombs, to try to put that in perspective. The bomb that completely obliterated Hiroshima. Think about 10 billion of those. I mean, you can't even conceive of that. Now, that was one of the five great mass extinctions that occurred. The question is, on the part of a lot of paleontologists, is really, how did anything survive the severe consequences of that event? Well, when I look out my window today, things look pretty calm and placid out there. The sun is shining. The birds are chirping. There are beautiful blue sky. Clouds are in the sky. I mean, there may be some chemtrails up there, but nonetheless, things look pretty calm, and I'm pretty confident that, tomorrow morning it's going to be another day similar to this. We may get some rainfall tomorrow, and it's going to be probably a hot summer like it always is here in the, southern America. But nonetheless, there's nothing going on out there that would be equivalent to all of the vegetation on Earth burning down. Nothing like a cosmic winter being superimposed in the aftermath of that. Nothing like, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years of almost total darkness around the planet from all of the soot and the ash in the atmosphere. Nothing like the thousands of cubic miles of dirt and ash that's filling the atmosphere as a result of the impact itself. So, when you think of it in that context, I mean, how do we say that what's going on now is comparable to an event like that? I personally think it's ludicrous.
Well, you know, again, the whole environmental movement is essentially just designed to make humanity the enemy. And as far as I know from the one of the founders of the environmental movement who went on to create Sea Shepherd, he separated from that whole green movement thing because he saw that it was being infiltrated and being taken over and becoming under the control of people who were essentially just hardcore communists. And if people are the enemy, what's the solution to that? Exterminate everybody? I think a communist dictatorship would probably be up to the task, don't you?
I think I would concur completely with that. And yes, it's true. I think that what has happened is the science of environmentalism has been replaced by the politics of environmentalism. Mm. And I don't think at this point the political environmentalists are actually doing any good for the environment at all. I mean, it's a political agenda of control. They're still laboring under this misconception that, you know, what we're doing to the Earth is something just unprecedented in its severity and its destructiveness. But they're refusing to look at, you know, the scientific data that's there now that, you know, when I get into discussions, debates with folks quite frequently on this question, because I've been fairly public in my expressing my opinions on it. So I get challenged when I say that, you know, global warming isn't all it's hacked up to be. You know, that, yes, there's probably an element of truth to that. I certainly believe that by adding 100 parts per million of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere would probably increase the temperature of the planet by maybe a quarter of a degree in 100 years. But I think that the, you know, basically it's been the whole question, again, has been hijacked to serve a political agenda of basically human control.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be the, it's the story of the 20th century. And if you look back, it's the story of human existence. Somebody's always trying to hijack and use a crisis for their own ends.